Hi, everybody. I'm a recovering compulsive eater and I'm a member of the Saturday Solutions Group. My name is Gary. And as you can tell from the size of this meeting, these three chapters, to wives, family afterward, and to the employer, are probably not the most popular chapters in the book. Probably, there's a lot of value in them, there's some value in them. I'm pretty convinced, personally, that if the book were being written today, these chapters wouldn't be in the book. Certainly not to the employer, maybe to the wives, certainly the family afterwards, maybe. But there's a lot to them. And so what I thought I'd do is talk a little bit about the chapters themselves and what they do and what they seem to offer and how they relate to the traditions and working the traditions, in terms of our family, in terms of our work life. And it makes sense. After the 12th step, in chapter 7 in the big book, where Bill Wilson talks about working with others, he says the 12th step is about practicing these principles in all our affairs. And then the following chapters list what are the basics of all our affairs, like, our spouse, our family, and our work life. Although most of us, we also have to deal with working, practicing these principles on the highway and in the grocery store, and with everybody else. But, the basics of our affairs are covered in our family and our spouse and our work life. And the traditions, like the steps, are kind of designed to, if not eliminate, at least reduce selfishness and to help us be part of something bigger than ourselves. That's why the traditions are often talked about in terms of relationship. They teach us how to have relationships, how to belong to something bigger than ourselves. And truly belonging to something, belonging to anything, a family, a workplace, a career, belonging to a fellowship, is a spiritual practice. It means sublimating our own personalities, our own wishes, our own desires, our own desire for control, all the stuff that we work through in the steps. So anyhow, chapter 2, the wives, I don't have a lot to say about it because it's kind of a disingenuous chapter. And those of you who are here probably know this. Bill wrote this. It's not written by one of the wives, even though it says as Wives of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says that, but it ain't true. It ain't true. And the story is that this really infuriated Lois, and she almost divorced him over this. In part, and I just read this in a recent history, he had offered this chapter to Ann Smith, to Dr. Bob's wife. And Dr. Bob's wife, in humility, turned down the opportunity to write the chapter. Because Dr. Bob's wife did work with families a lot more than Lois did. The development of AA on the East Coast in New York is very different from the development of AA in Akron and Cleveland. So they had, slightly different focuses and slightly different behaviors. But this chapter to the wives, what it does mostly is it talks to the wife about how she might 12-step her husband. So it really is a continuation of working with others. And while it does not say a lot that for our use, it does paint a pretty clear picture of what it's like to live with one of us. And the extreme selfishness, the extreme, even in here, Bill keeps making the wife or the spouse, or the partner, responsible for our recovery. Bill keeps talking about like, don't get upset, don't get angry, don't nag him, because if you nag him, he's likely to resist and that sort of stuff. But it also talks about how to leave the book available to him and how to 12-step him. It says, wait until he's jittery, wait until he stumbles, when he's had a hard time. And that is true. Most of us as addicts do better when we're struggling. There's nothing more dangerous than an addict whose life is going well. Addicts are people who figure out what works and then stop doing it. It says it might be easier to convince him to pick up this way of life if he's stumbling and if he's having a hard time. And I can relate to a lot of that. But he also talks in this chapter about the power of God. He says the power of God goes deep. and talks about the fact that a lot of alcoholics, a lot of recovering people like ourselves, have other disorders aside from our eating disorders. We have other disorders. The people you meet in 12-step rooms aren't necessarily bastions of mental health. That's the reason why we're here. And it talks about the embarrassment of living with one of us. And I've got to say, when I did my eight-step amends list, part of that to my family, I weighed 340 pounds when I came in. And my daughter was like almost 3 years old when I came in. She was 3 and a half when I came in, but those last couple of years. And aside from all the horrible mood swings and all the terrible things I had done, I was aware of how hurtful it must have been, how embarrassing it must have been to be a young mother with a husband weighing 340 pounds, knowing that I could die at any moment. And aside from the death stuff, just the embarrassment of it. We went to one of her family dinners, my first wife. This is my first wife, who is still my second most favorite wife. My first wife, I lost 115 pounds on a diet, and we went to her family, and everybody was so proud of me and so happy. The next time they saw me, I had gained back 130 pounds. How embarrassing that must have been to live with one of us, what that must be like. I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't put up with one of us. One of the nice things about being an addict is we tend to find good codependents to work with and live with to help us in our disease. And the family afterwards does have a lot of really real value to it in terms of how to work the traditions, how to work the steps and to live this program. I love the opening phrase of the chapter is "Our Women Folk," which lets you know this was written in 1939. Like, I can't imagine how much trouble we would get in today if I said "Our Women Folk." It's kind of absurd, but he admits here, perhaps that chapter to the wives created the impression that he is to be wrapped in cotton wool and placed on a pedestal. Successful readjustment means just the opposite. All members of the family should meet upon a common ground of tolerance, understanding, and love. What a great principle. And this is something in terms of traditions and in terms of living these principles in all our affairs that works for us. All members of the family should meet upon the common ground of tolerance, understanding, and love. The thing is, and the thing I always tell my sponsees, is you have to remember our spouses, our children, our family members, our friends don't necessarily have a program. They're allowed to be a selfish prick. There's nothing stopping them from being completely selfish and completely demanding, and that's fine. I have no right to expect anything else from them. There are other expectations upon me because my life depends on tolerance, understanding, and love. My life depends on my developing those skills. And I've got to say, for me, I developed those skills in OA and in OA rooms much faster than I did at home. My first 5 years in recovery, I was at least as crazy as I was my last 5 years of disease. I wasn't obsessed with food, but I was just amazed. A friend of mine used to say that for every pound of weight we lose 2 pounds of anger. And I was just an argument looking to happen all the time. And I have to say that people who suffered most from this were the people closest to me. I wish that weren't true. My first wife has passed now. And I stayed with her in the hospital as she was dying and whatnot. But man, I wish I was a better husband, especially during those early years of recovery. Yeah, I really do. There's that. And then the chapter, I'll just say briefly a few things about the chapter to the employer. The chapter to the employer is written by a guy named Hank Parkhurst. Hank Parkhurst is the closest thing we have to a genuine co-founder in terms of the writing of the big book. Dr. Bob wasn't all that involved in the writing of the big book. Hank Parkhurst was. And you can tell from this chapter, Hank Parkhurst didn't really like the spiritual, what he called the spiritual angle that much. And it was, he was mostly concerned with what they called the psychological approach, which was one of the big differences between New York and Akron. And, And you can tell from this chapter, you know, Bill and Hank were hustlers. They weren't these quiet, happy little humble guys like Dr. Bob, just, you know, taking care of alcoholics. They had big plans. What they called the book project was just one part of a project in terms of they were going to develop hospitals and education centers and all this stuff. And the book was really just a way of raising money to do all that stuff. So you can tell in this chapter, Hank and Bill were selling stock in AA at one point. They were selling shares of stock. And Hank here is largely concerned with selling books. He's largely concerned with selling books. He suggests that junior executives be given a copy of the book so they know how to deal with alcoholics. In all honesty, I think this would be more useful to us if it was written to the employee, telling us how to behave as employees. But instead, it's written to the employer, again, looking for the employer to 12-step his employees or her employees, to 12-step people. And so those are the chapters. And my favorite line, probably my favorite line in the whole big book, is in the chapter to the family on page 132. In the very center of the page, 16 lines from the top, 16 lines from the bottom, two words from the left, two words from the right, is my favorite line. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. And we do. Recovery is a joyous way of life. So in terms of the traditions, in terms of practicing this, you know, all of these chapters are about belonging to something bigger than ourselves, about being something bigger than ourselves, and that is a spiritual practice. You know, the 12th tradition, anonymity, the foundation of all these traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. I always thought that the principles before personalities thing meant that I was going to tolerate people I don't like, like people I'm doing service with or people in my family, and I'm going to put up with them. And there's some truth to that, because if you like everybody you're doing service with, or you like everybody you're going to meetings with, you're not going to enough meetings and you're not doing enough service. It's just that simple. I love everybody. I love everybody in program. But the chances of my liking 50 people are pretty slim. If you knew how judgmental I was, the chances of my liking 50 people are pretty slim. So it's not just putting up with what the 12th principle, the 12th tradition means, as I take it, when it says principles before personality, is that the personality that needs to be sublimated is mine. It is my wishes, my desire for control. All that stuff has to be sublimated so that I can belong and treat others as equals, so that I can focus on unity instead of getting my own way, so I can recognize that even in my family there is a higher power that is directing our lives and taking care of us, so that when I'm on the highway, I can remember that the only requirement to be on the highway is a desire to be on the highway. There's no requirement that you drive the way I believe you should drive. Like, there's no requirement that if you're in the left lane, you must go this fast. The only requirement is a desire to be there, and I have no right to demand otherwise. Now, the idea of autonomy, that my family members are not there for me to control, that they're not there for me to decide how they would or should or could live, that they're autonomous. At the same time, we have to think about how our behavior affects the family or the workplace as a whole, and we have to bring that all to bear. No opinion on outside issues. I'll close with this. It's in terms of, I used to go to this men's meeting, North Miami Men's Group, and they had this spiritual maxim, and it really relates to this tradition, tradition 10. And the spiritual maxim that they repeated, like, it was this huge group, and everybody would say it at once, and we would all say, here's our spiritual maxim. Mind your own effing business. We didn't say effing, but you get the idea. We use the word. And that was our spiritual insight. And I gotta tell you, minding my own business is a tough bro to hoe. It is a tough spiritual practice. I get upset over the principle of the thing. And whenever I'm upset over the principle of the thing, I know I'm full of crap. It's something that doesn't even affect me. And knowing when outside issues, when things that don't affect me are making me crazy because I like being right, how much that disrupts the family, how much that disrupts the workplace, how much that disrupts my loved ones. I hope that was of some value, and I hope it wasn't too fast for the interpreters. And now you'll hear some real truth from BJ.
Always a comedian. Thank you, Gary. That was beautiful. My name is BJ. I'm a food addict. I'm so grateful to be here with you guys. I'm so humbled to be here. Some of my favorite people are on this meeting, so I'm grateful to be on the journey with them. I pray, I say what God wants me to say, and you hear what God wants you to hear. I do have to say I'm abstinent and sober all through the loving grace of God and this 12-step program of recovery and Overeaters Anonymous. I'm very loyal and to institutions and people that saved my life, and OA has saved my life and given me a life. And so having said that, I keep my program super simple. I do 9 tools, 12 steps, 12 traditions, a day at a time, a moment at a time. The steps are the greatest thing I've ever done in my life without exception. They gave me this relationship to God. I like to keep, I want to say short sentences, and that's how my brain works. And so I have to remind myself that the solution is 100% spiritual. God's the answer. What's the question? If I don't feel close to God, it's like I have to remind myself, guess who moved? And so, I stay very close to the 12 steps and 12 traditions. So I did want to go back to the introduction, and it's on page 89. I just want to read a little bit of it. It's really helpful for me in studying the traditions. It says, Overeaters Anonymous has 12 traditions that are designed to keep our meetings and service bodies on track, functioning in a way as to nurture the recovery of all compulsive overeaters who seek help in this fellowship. The study of the traditions shows how these 12 suggestions have worked to help individuals, groups, and OA as a whole solve problems, thrive, and be effective instruments for carrying the message of recovery to those who still suffer. Then it goes on to say the 12 traditions embody spiritual principles for living. Those who have studied them carefully have found that these traditions can be applied effectively to all human relationships, both inside and outside of OA. With this in mind, we turn our attention to the traditions, trusting that as we come to understand them better, we will better be able to keep OA strong and healthy and ourselves spiritually fit in the face of all challenges. So it's a lot, but it reminds me that just being abstinent and working the steps isn't enough. It can't be my God. Working the steps can't be God. Working the traditions can't be my God. Working with tools can't be my God. They lead me to God. God is God. And with that, I want to say OA doesn't have a monopoly on miracles. But concerning my family and my relationships, my program has to come first. Anything I put before my program, I lose. And my husband knows that. He knows it's God, my program, and then him. And he's okay with that. I do tell young people that if you're dating, ask your partner to go to Al-Anon. It says in the literature that there is another fellowship, and I think it's the family after, and we suggest you go to it. I said, I don't want diamonds. I don't want flowers. I don't want chocolate. I want you to go to Al-Anon. And he was like, oh, my God, you know, I don't have to spend all that money. He was, like, so happy. So he went to Al-Anon, and he went for 7 years. And 1 week they'd study the steps, 1 week they'd study the traditions, and 1 week they'd study the concepts. So he'd come home talking about the concepts. It was, like, so over my head. But Yeah, it helps for me. It helps me to not have a partner who is in the disease. My first husband was in the disease. I chose someone who, I'm going to say, ate more than I did. So if they're a food addict, I'm a food addict. Anyway, that was husband number one, and then husband number two was also an addict, and so I finally got it on husband number three, and so I prayed every day for 7 years, God, when that person is ready and I'm ready, please put them in my life. And people would say, BJ, are you dating? I'm like, nope, God does not want me to date because I've prayed every day. So I believe in the power of prayer. And I had to be 100%. I don't believe in this 50% and 50% make 100%. I believe in 100% and 100%. So the best thing that I can do with my family is to stay abstinent, get abstinent and stay abstinent and work my program. I do want to say I came in 1996, and so I've been married for a little over 18 years, and I worked the steps, front, backwards, whatever. Somewhere along the line, my abstinent date is 2014. I'm a bulimic, and my disease started very young, so I had a lot of experience in my disease, and I was bulimic from age 15 to age 27. And it is a soul sickness that only a bulimic knows, to be purging and tied to a toilet. But, so somewhere along, my abstinence in 1996 was not to purge, no sugar, nothing with a calorie, because I believed that would, I was using it like a drug, and then, be a healthy body weight. But anyway, so somewhere along the line, the artificial sweeteners got more sophisticated, and I was making trays and trays of gluten-free, sugar-free desserts and eating trays and trays, so I started my disease over, but my disease over, my abstinence date over. But what I want to say about that is my husband still can't believe that this program works. He used to come home, and I'd have breakfast, lunch, and dinner by 8 a.m. thinking I wasn't going to eat the whole day, right? And that never worked. And so, like, he'll still ask me at 5 o'clock, have you had dinner? I'm like, no, it's 5 o'clock or 4 o'clock. I haven't had dinner, you know, or have you had lunch at 11? It's like, no, it's only 11. It's just a miracle to us every day that I'm on the other side of this disease. I do not take that lightly. And so that's why I work my program like my life depends on it, because my marriage depends on it. My relationship with my family depends on it. My life depends on it. I am one of those people that would be dead without this program. So having said that, it's also part of my living amends. I've had to make amends to my employer, my boss, my whatever, ex-husband. That was really interesting. And I've seen one of them since skiing, and he invited me to ski together. I don't have to cross the street to, when I see someone. I have loving relationships. I used to click my heels and salute when my sister walked by. I called her Sarge. And now I call her Sissy. I mean, we just have a loving relationship, and we text each other, and everything has changed. You know, when I did a fourth step on my parents, and now I know the steps, but you can see that the steps have to be in this place. My mom had like 9 pages of resentments, and she has passed, but I call her Mama, and we just had a loving, loving, loving relationship. I can't say enough about living in recovery. But in reading these steps, my home group, the first week, it's Broomfield, 8:30 on Saturday, We read the big book the first week of the month. We read the step of the month the second week. We read the tradition of the month on the third week, and the fourth and fifth we have seekers. But I forget what I was going to say about that. We've gone through the big book like 5 times from cover to cover in the last 12 years. But to the wives, it keeps me sober. I do not want to have my husband go through that story. You know, there's a lot of yes in my program. You're eligible too. And it scares me. These 3 chapters scare me into sobriety with food. And then, you know how you read something and it's like, oh, that's where they got that phrase. There's this phrase to the family, we alcoholics are sensitive people. It takes us, some of us, a long time to outgrow that serious handicap. Someone says something I don't like, you know, I have to remember that I'm a sensitive person. And then I have, thank you, Brian, I have to give that back to other people. I have to have that humility and empathy that I've done that 10 times worse. You know, whatever the fault is, they say if I'm pointing a finger at someone, I have 3 coming back to me. So, yeah, if I'm to be of maximum service, that was my spiritual awakening. My job is to be of maximum service to God and my fellows. How can I serve my family? How can I serve my husband? I like that phrase, stick with winners. I like to surround myself with people who work a hard program or a strong program. And so sometimes I'll say, well, what would my sponsor do? What would she say? And so that whole thing of how do I build someone up instead of tear someone down? Instead of looking for all the faults, I wouldn't want my friends to look for all my faults, you know, look to all their good qualities. Like my best friend, if she says something off the wall, I know 95% of her is good, and that's just an off the wall thing like I would have said. And so, yeah, that's kind of what I got out of a lot of these. I think Gary said, you know, we are not a glum lot. We insist on having fun. There's so many just great nuggets in here about laughter and then the other side of it is the tragic side. All I know is just to keep it simple. I can ask for help. I remember one time we were reading the traditions in our face-to-face, and we didn't get 6, 7, and 8. So we started a summer-long program that we met every Friday from 4 to 6, the studies, traditions 6, 7, and 8. It's like, if we don't know something, we can just study it. And then I have to say one last thing about anonymity. I don't tell someone else's story. It's their job to tell their story. I can share the message, but it was never about the messenger. Like, people do not know who my sponsor is. My husband knows who my sponsor is. In our face-to-face meetings, like if we get together for lunch and whatever, someone will tell a story and they're so shocked that no one else knows it. It's like, because we haven't told their story, it's up to them to tell that part of their story, what's happening in their life. And that follows through with my friends. I don't tell my other friends their story or it's up to them. So that whole anonymity has really helped me. It's not about stars or VIPs, who's in the club. We're all in the cool club, you know. God loves us, you know. God gave us OA, and then OA gave us God. And all I have to do is just keep coming back and keep hanging around you guys. So thank you for being here.
Thank you to both our speakers. So we're going to start the, we're going to do a few minutes of question and answer. So I, you know, I struggle with some of these chapters because I'm a child of an abusive alcoholic. And I kind of feel like they didn't take responsibility for being the drunks they were when I read them. And I understand that I'm a food addict and how it's impacted my family. And I actually consider my abstinence part of my living amends because I know the things I couldn't do because I was so morbidly obese that I couldn't show up for life. Right. But at the same time, I still struggle with particularly these chapters in the big book for that reason. Like I feel like it's someone writing, if you did those kind of things, like you're not really, it almost sounds to me like they didn't fully accept the damage that they did to their families. I don't know. It's just my feeling and I probably shouldn't judge it that way. But I wondered like if you all have perspective on that. Either BJ or Gary.
Well, like I said, there's no question that, especially the chapter to the wives, is a disingenuous chapter. I mean, it's one of the selling points, if you want to call it that, of the big book, is that it's based on experience rather than theory. And with the exception of that chapter, that chapter is theoretical. And while it has, like I said, it has some real value, it definitely shows a picture of what it's like to live with one of us, it is disingenuous. And these are chapters, you know, when they were writing the big book, they had other goals. And some of those goals were to educate and to help other people take, you know, like the employer 12-step lesson, the wife 12-step lesson. Some of those goals wouldn't be part of the creation of that book today. So that... some of it, like a lot of the stuff in the big book, has to be placed in some sort of historical context. You know, there's a lot of language in there that contemporary readers might find offensive. I don't know what to say other than to kind of agree with you. There are parts of that of those first two chapters, particularly to the family and to the wives, where it does seem like where the wife and the family is being made responsible for the addict. But we don't have to read it that way and we don't have to live it that way. You know, I was able to use those chapters to see how I was treating my family, how I was treating my spouse, and learn to behave differently, to behave more like both what God would have me be and in all honesty, who I would rather be. Even though the directions in the chapters aren't necessarily as clear about that as I would like. Thank you.
I see it as some of it you take what you like and leave the rest. I do believe in many instances the alcoholic feels worse, even though it's not communicated to the person. It's like we all want the same thing, to be loved and to have a community. And it is like a tornado running through. All hearts are broken. The deepest roots are, you know, rooted. And then the alcoholic comes out and says, "Ain't things grandma? You know, I've stopped eating." It's a horrible disease. Yeah, I wouldn't wish it on anyone. You know, we suffer, everyone suffers. That's why maybe it can help another, you know, and the hope is that we help someone to pay for, you know, a lifetime of being in the disease. Some things can't be explained, honestly, I think.
Thank you. We have one more question. So the other question is, how do you keep calm in family situations, trying to change attitude and restraining from reacting, you know, staying in love and tolerance, and how to stay sane when you're around people that, you know, are not in program that may not be sane. practicing the same principles and traditions that we want.
I do believe you have to put the mask on first, you know, first things first. Like when I go to travel with my to see my family, I've seen them 3 times in the last year and spent 2 months with them. You know, my sobriety comes first. I take my food on the plane. I land. I go to the grocery store. I can read and write and call my sponsor. I have to pause when agitated or doubtful and ask God for the next right thought or action. And sometimes it's just to, you know, how important is it really? Do I want to be right? Do I want to be happy? What would God have me do? That empathy. Sometimes I just leave, whatever. It's like I'm, you know, I make sure I meditate every morning and do my part to suit up. But I think it's said in one of the chapters, remember, we are sick people. You know, it's like we're all spiritual beings trying to have a human experience. And back to, have I done that same thing? And I don't know, just a lot of love and tolerance. Make sure I'm not in halt. I'm not hungry, angry, lonely, tired, stressed or sick. So it's like a full-time job. That's all I got to say. So, thanks.
As far as staying calm in face of family members and others who don't work a program, all I can say is practice. There's no question that I'm much more stable, much more calm today than I was in my early years of recovery. It takes a lot more to get me upset, and even when I'm upset, I don't act that way. I don't behave that way. You know, in the chapter to the family afterwards, Bill Wilson says years of living with an alcoholic or an addict or a compulsive eater would make any family neurotic, would make anybody crazy. And that idea that addiction is a family illness was so ahead of its time, so like, you know, what an insight to have in 1939, you know, that the whole family is affected by this. And like I said before, I do have to remember that people don't have a program are entitled to behavior that I'm not entitled to. They're welcome to it. And sometimes it's just about keeping my mouth shut and keeping my opinions to myself. My sponsor tells me that, and this is just an example, but he says if I'm ever upset with my wife, and he's talking about my wife, but it could be anybody. He said, the reason I'm upset is that I'm a selfish, petty little man. And I don't have to talk to my wife about that because she already knows I'm a petty, selfish little man. So when I'm upset, it is very important that I express my feelings. But it's important that I express them to my sponsor or a friend or part of my God squad. I do not need to share with the person I'm upset with why I'm upset with them. They don't need to hear the crap in my head any more than I need to hear the crap in their head. So it's important that I know to speak and I know to share my truth, but I know with whom I can share that truth. And it never needs to be the person who I think offended. Anyhow, I hope that helps.
Thank you, and thank both for your shares.